Hebrews chapter 11, verse 20 this morning. This evening we'll be continuing through this chapter verse by verse. We come to Isaac this morning, and it says, "By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come." More properly, to give you the sense of what that verse reads like, it is by faith, and that's what we're looking at, and that in relation to things to come, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau. That's the emphasis, is it puts the things to come in relationship to the faith. So by faith, Isaac, in relationship to things to come, blessed Jacob and Esau. It was in relationship to the promises made to Abraham. It was in relationship to the promises made about the land. It was in relationship to that city that Abraham looked for. It was in relationship to the things that you and I looked for. And the remarkable sequence here, as we look one verse on Jacob, one verse on Isaac, one verse on Joseph, these next three verses, we look at these men not during their pilgrimage like Abraham, not at their call, but at the end of their pilgrimage, each one of these men passed on to the next generation the things that we have been studying. And the remarkable thing is that Jacob, at the end of his life, passed on to the next generation that legacy of things that were looked for in regards to the promise made to Abraham, in regards to the Messiah and the kingdom. Though he had not seen them, he had lived out his life as the promised seed and ended his life with great difficulty, by the way, and had not seen the promises of God, and yet passed on that legacy to the next generation. As we study this verse, it does not lend itself to an easy interpretation either, because as we look at him at the end of his life, we see him embroiled in a family situation with all kinds of problems. In fact, as we look at Isaac, we don't get the print on Isaac that we get on Abraham, and he's not the man that Abraham was. Abraham was the guy who was adventurous, that was led out to the land. There were conquests. Abraham was the guy that loaded up his 318 armed servants and went after you if you messed with him or messed with his family. Isaac just seemed to be more passive. He allowed himself to be bound on Moriah. He allowed them to bring the wife to him he should marry. When he dug a well and somebody hassled him, he moved on, much different than Abraham. And of course, after him is Jacob, and he wasn't the crook that Jacob was. He's not the schemer that Jacob was. He's not the character and doesn't get the print that Jacob gets. And yet he, you know, still we read of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And as we look at this scene of him blessing Jacob and Esau, It has its difficulties because we don't have all of the information we might like to have about Isaac. We see the family situation where in 23 of Genesis, Isaac gets his wife, Rebekah, and she is barren. And Isaac prays for her that she would conceive, and she does. And she comes to Isaac and to the Lord and says, "If this be the Lord, why is this going on?" An extremely difficult pregnancy. Again, no OBGYN guys around. She has twins. And she's saying, "If this is the Lord, and this is the answer to prayer, why is this all so difficult?" And God speaks to her and says, "Because there are two nations in your womb." Now, that'll present a problem to any woman. And the Lord tells Rebekah, "You're going to have two children, and the one will be stronger than the other, but the older will serve the younger." And we see this reversal of the blessing again, as we saw it with Abel, Cain and Abel, as we saw it with Abraham, as we see it here with Jacob, as we see it David, the youngest of eight. Well, many times in Scripture, it is the younger that ends up with the blessing, and so it will be by God's election in this case also, that Jacob would be the one that would receive the blessing. And yet we see Isaac at the end of his life, if we just consider the scene of blessing here, wrestling with that idea. It tells us that he loved Esau because of the venison that Esau brought him. Now that's not a good way to set your priorities. But I think as I look at Isaac, he reflects more of us than does either Abraham or Jacob. I think we probably won't be, most of us, the adventurer that Abraham was, and hopefully few of us will be the crook that Jacob was, but we'll be the man that that Isaac was, dwelling quietly, which is almost a misnomer. Here's a guy named Laughter who spends his life in quietness. Maybe he just got tired of answering the question. I don't know. We see him playing favorites with his sons, demonstrating tremendous favoritism, which was not right. He was partial to Esau, and yet he grew up in that environment. The promised son. Though Abraham loved both Ishmael and Isaac, Sarah was so bitter about the attitude of Hagar and of Ishmael towards Isaac that she drove Isaac's brother out of the family. And Isaac had grown up with an example of extreme favoritism in his own house. And so he reproduces it. He demonstrates it here in that he has a greater sensitivity and draw towards Esau. And I think also because of his nature, his quietness, you know, here's a guy who was the son of his father's old age in the sense that when he's born, Abraham is 100 years old. And by the time you're 100 years old, you got your priorities sifted out. You know, you don't have the same priorities as you did when you were 16 or 18 or 20 or 30 or 40. You're 100 years old. At that time, you know what's important and what's not. And a lot of water has gone under the bridge that you thought was going to murder you along the way that doesn't. And you've got a certain perspective and a certain solidness, I imagine, at 100 years old. And Isaac grew up under that. Born when Abraham was 100, and it tells us in the end of chapter 21 that he spent those first 30-some years at Beersheba, where Abraham had digged a well and had an experience with the everlasting God and called it the well of the oath. And Isaac becomes fond of those quiet times then, dwelling by wells. In fact, chapter 26 and 27 of Genesis tell us about Isaac. And in those two chapters, as we look at him, he is predominantly a man that's digging wells. Seven times in his short history, he's related to a well. And he spends those first 30 years in quietness there at Beersheba. And maybe he likes Esau because of that. Esau was the hunter. Esau was a man's man. Esau was hairy. You know, he was out shooting deer and hunting. And he, you know, maybe he was drawn to that and liked that about Esau. And of course, Rebekah heard him say that to Esau, look, I'm old now. I don't know how much longer I'm going to be alive. He lived to be 180. He was blind. And he said, Esau, go on out and fetch me some venison, cook it up the way I like it. Before I die, I want to put the blessing on your life. And of course, Rebekah began scheming and got Jacob and had him put the goat skin on his hand to make himself feel hairy and put Esau's clothes on so he smelled like the field and deceived the blind patriarch. In so much that when Esau came in and said, okay, I'm ready for my blessing, and Isaac said, I already bless you. And Esau said, No, you didn't. I'm me. I'm here. Who was it? And it says that Isaac began to shake, convulse. He began to tremble extremely or greatly, it says, because in his heart he had realized what he had done. He had realized that he had not paid heed to Rebekah, who told him the Lord said the younger would be the one who would receive the blessing. And he realized at that moment that God in his sovereignty had overridden his own mistake and his own carnality. And he said to Esau, no, I have blessed, and that one will be blessed. I will not revoke the blessing. And he certainly, by faith, and we'll look at that, goes on to bless Jacob again and to see Esau live out in his blessing. But the reason he was able to do that as we look at him is I see this man first. You know, we have a brief history, 30 years at Beersheba. No real record of what took place. The first time we get a close look at Isaac is when Abraham is leading him to Moriah. And as we look at Abraham offering up his son, we center on Abraham. We center on God. And yet imagine Isaac at that time, about 33 and a half years old, his father, 130 years old, And the Josephus gives us the traditional dialogue that was taking place by Hebrew tradition between Abraham and Isaac. And it's pretty much the way you would imagine it as they went together. And Isaac being raised with this quiet, steady, 130-year-old man who loved God with all of his heart, having this father of his tell him, this is where our God has brought us. This is the way he has asked us to worship. And if need be, I know he can raise you from the dead. I'm not sure what's going on. He has something to say to us. We will go. We will obey. And Isaac at 30 years old, yielding himself, allowing his father to bind him, a man in the youth of his strength, able easily to overpower Abraham, willingly lets himself be bound and placed upon the altar. And imagine the scene as he sees the knife raised. He bends his knee to his father and to his father's God and hears the angel of the Lord stop the process and hears the bleeding of a ram caught in the thicket and knows that the God of his father Abraham can provide in a supernatural way from that moment on. And no one could ever say to Isaac that his father's God was not alive, because he knew that he was alive because Abraham's God was alive. And that Abraham's God was not alive, he in fact would have died on the altar. And the interesting thing is, the next time we see him, Sarah is dead. Abraham sends his servant back to his Padan Aram, the land he grew up in, to take a wife for Isaac of his kinsfolk. And of course, Eleazar, which means the comforter, goes back to the homeland and brings Rebekah to Isaac. And Isaac, a beautiful type of Christ, yielded himself willingly on Moriah. The next time it says Abraham and the servants return from Moriah, no mention of Isaac. The next time we see Isaac is when Eleazar, the comforter, is bringing the bride to him. And of course, like Christ in the church, the last thing we saw of Jesus was his death and resurrection, his ascension to heaven. The next time he will be seen is when the comforter brings his church, his bride, to him. And the beautiful types are all there. But Isaac at that point in time is living at the well Lahoirai. He has camped himself there. Sarah is dead. He has his own tent, finally, and he pitches it by the well of the one who lives and sees. Because next to Moriah, it was the most sacred spot he knew. He was raised on the knees of Hagar. He was tutored by her as a young man. He knew the story well of how Sarah had driven her out in her pregnancy and how God had preserved her life. And there God brought forth water in the desert and named it the well of him who lives and sees, Ber Leheroi. So he is camped there quietly by that well as his bride is brought to him. And again, a man living, as it were, in quietness. Turn to Genesis chapter 25 as we see some snapshots of this man. Genesis 25:11 says, "And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt by the well Leheroi." Again, turn over to verse chapter 26, verse 17. Isaac is leaving the Philistine country. He has been living there under Abimelech, making a similar mistake to Abraham. And now as he is leaving, it says, "Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac digged again the wells of water which they had digged in the days of Abraham, his father. For the Philistines, the perpetual enemy of God's people, had stopped them after the death of Abraham. And he called their names," interesting, "after the names by which his father had called them." He called the wells by the same names that he had remembered as a boy, his father opening these wells. "And Isaac's servants digged in the valley and found there a well of springing water," living water. "And the herdmen of Gerar did strive with Isaac's herdmen, saying, 'The water is ours.' So he called the name of that well Esek, which is contention, because they strove with him. And he digged another well. They strove for that also, and he called the name of it Zitnah, which is hatred. And he removed from there, and he digged another well, for that they strove not. And he called the name of that Rehoboth, which is that he had been given place, or that there was room for him, and he said that he would then flourish. Verse 23 says, "And he went up from there to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared unto him the same night." This is where he had grown up the first 30 years of his life. "And he said, I am the God of Abraham, thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee. And I will bless thee and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake. And he builded an altar there and called on the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there," notice, "and there Isaac's servants digged a well." Over again, verse 32, "And it came to pass the same day that Isaac's servants came and told him concerning the well that they had digged, and said unto him, We have found water, and he called it Sheba," which is oath. Therefore, the name of the city is Beersheba unto this day, the God of the oath. So it's interesting, as we look at his life, this is the only record we really have of him. The first scene we see of him is at Moriah, and no doubt an incredible impression made upon his heart as this young boy growing up under an ancient patriarch is moved by the angel of the Lord and by the sparing of his life, and he leaves there and moves away in quietness to sit by a well, the well of the God who lives and sees, for many years in quietness, so impressed with what had taken place. It's almost as though he has no drive to accomplish anything on the physical plane. His heart, I believe, is taken up with the things of God. And as he does move, we find him digging wells. We find him opening up the wells of his father. And I think it is a great part of his character. And as I look at that, of course, I understand the types. Jesus had said to us, "Behold, any man who thirsts, let him come to me and drink. And he that believes on me, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water." The Bible has much to say to you and I about partaking of God's blessing and the water that he has for us. Isaiah says, "Ho, everyone that thirsteth, come ye to the waters. He that has no money, come ye buy and eat." Without money and without price. "Wherefore do you spend your money, spend yourselves on that which is not bread, and your labor for that which satisfieth not? Hearken diligently to me, and eat that which is good, and let your soul delight itself in fatness. Incline your ear, and come unto me, hear, and your soul shall live, and I will make an everlasting covenant with you." Jeremiah said this to the nation of Israel as they turned away, "For my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed out cisterns, broken cisterns that can hold no water. Thine own wickedness shall correct thee, thine backsliding shall reprove thee. Know therefore and see that it is an evil thing and bitter thou hast forsaken the Lord thy God, and that my fear is not in thee, saith the Lord of hosts." So through the Bible, typically, this idea of wells and of springs of water, God has taken it to himself because his nature, his love, his goodness towards us is likened to wells and springs of water in a land where we understand that hatred and contention seem to be the order of the day in the world that we live in. And yet I think how important it is for us as a nation to open up the springs that our fathers drank from as they came here for religious freedom, as they came here to raise their children with morality, as they came here to give their hearts and their lives to God, to worship open with their families. And then they lived in an era when no one made fun of traditional American family values, and no one made fun of the fact that there was a Judeo-Christian ethic. And look what our nation has drunk of. Look where it is now. We have sown to the wind. We're reaping the whirlwind. Our nation has partaken of every foul spring that you can drink from. And look at the condition it's left us in. Look where it's brought us to. And I think as a nation, we need to return to the wells that our fathers drank from. We need to unclog them and take out the things that Satan has put in them to stop them up and to keep us from drinking. I think as a church in America, how simple it is that we would return to the scripture, that we would return to prayer, that we would return to the things that matter. I am amazed at the ministers and pastors that come to talk to us and ask us what the secret is, and we wonder because we don't know any. We should write a book, The Secret of Whatever You Want to Know. When the Billy Graham Crusade was here and they did their youthquake, which was a new thing that they were doing, and desired to gather together all the youth, the teenagers, junior high kids before the crusade. They gathered together first the youth leaders from the churches across the city, and as they talked, they decided, what will our workshops be on? What will we talk about? And they decided, well, let's talk about homosexuality, some said. Let's talk about AIDS. And finally, some of our guys stood up and said, does Billy Graham know you guys are doing this? What are you guys, all crazy? Well, you know, we have these kids. Let's talk to them about warfare. Let's talk to them about compromise. Let's talk to them about the grace of God. Let's talk to them about the world they're living in. And it rallied some of the courage of some of the other men to stand up and to say the same thing. But we need to get back to the wells that our fathers drank from, that Whitfield and that Spurgeon and that Moody and that Billy Graham and that those who founded our nation and those who revised the Bible and those who died at the stake. It's a very simple thing to get back to the God of our fathers, because look at what we've drunk from as a church. Look at what we're trying to produce with programs and with all kinds of things. We've produced no life and we've been left dead. And immorality has been the tide that has overwhelmed the influence we should have in the land, and how necessary it is for the church in America to get back to the springs that Satan has clogged up and to dig them up once again and find that the same refreshing is there. And it has to start as individuals, you and I. Where have we been trying to refresh ourselves? To what streams have we gone? And I think of my life before I came to Christ, the places I drank, trying to satisfy and fulfill that emptiness, to quench the thirst that I had within my soul, whether it was with pleasure or drugs or whatever it may have been, and the places that I went. And I found hatred, and I found strife, and I found contention. And maybe you're trying to drink from a relationship. You're trying to satisfy yourself from something. You're finding yourself in compromise, having walked away from the Lord. And Satan in your life, like the Philistines, the perpetual enemy of God's people, has stopped up by deceiving you those refreshing streams that should flow to your life. And how necessary it is as individuals that we come back to the simple truth, because look at the world, look at the warfare, and look at the hatred, and look at the disease that we're surrounded with. And God said his word would abide, and heaven and earth would pass away. It's interesting, in the preface to the new book called The Faithful Christian, G.G. Graham wrote it about her father, Billy Graham, and just snippets of his different sermons and perspectives on different subjects through the years, and watching him for these years, 50 years of successful ministry without a spot, without a blemish upon it. And she said, the amazing thing about him is, from the time I was able to understand English until now, he's never changed his approach, which is simply, thus saith the Lord. She said, I've watched the church go through a million changes. I've watched Christianity in America go up and down and flavor itself and paint itself and go through its programs. And she said, my father is saying the same thing that he said then, and that is, thus saith the Lord. And the same word of God that was good enough for Spurgeon or was good enough for Whitfield, the same truths are the only truths that are there for us to drink from, whether it be at Leheroy, the God of him that lives and sees. Maybe you feel like you're in a desert this morning. Maybe you feel like Hagar, driven out. Maybe you feel like there's reproach on your life. And maybe you feel like you're in a desert and you've been there and that God has forsaken you and you're about to die and that nobody cares about you. Maybe you're sitting in this crowded room and nobody around you knows what's really going on in your life and you feel isolated and you feel forsaken. And she discovered there the God that lives and sees, and named that well, the God of him who lives and sees, and discovered it in the desert. And maybe this morning you need to realize that everything else that you might turn to will only leave you thirsty. But there is a well. And Isaac lived there for years, and it's the well of the God who lives and sees, the living God. And I pray that you might find strength flowing to you this morning from that place. Or maybe it's Beersheba. Maybe you've walked away from the Lord and compromised, or you're backslidden, or maybe there's some sin that's taken hold of you and you feel condemned and you feel God is through with you and that his love is not sufficient for you. Isaac lived for years at Beersheba, the God of the oath, And he's promised us in Christ that he's never leave us or forsake us, that the bloodshed of Christ is sufficient, and that anyone who would turn to him with their heart, that he's faithful and just to forgive us if we come and return and confess. I remember for years before I knew Christ, not knowing where my life was going, not knowing what I want to do. The big question for years when you're a kid is, what do you want to be when you grow up? Maybe that's why you don't grow up, because you haven't figured it out. You're afraid somebody will ask you, and you won't know. No direction, not knowing what I want out of life, no sense of purpose. I remember 22 years old, 1972, when I first got saved. I looked at my parents and thought, my God, they have put up with me all these years. So suddenly there was awareness of other people than myself. And I thought the tears, the hardship, the sleepless nights, the worrying. But I discovered, like Isaac did at Rehoboth, that there is a place for me, you see. There is a purpose for my life. I didn't come from monkeys. I didn't get here by mistake. My ancestors didn't climb out of some slime, some ooze in a pond. God created me and has a purpose for my life, and knew me before I was born, as it says in Psalm 139, and made me an individual, as he had made Abraham an adventurer, and as he allowed those characters in Jacob that he used in the flesh that made him a crook. He also created Isaac in all of his wisdom, and I think God found great pleasure with Isaac sitting quietly for years in communion and fellowship by these wells and by these springs. And I think that it's because of that life that at the end he was able to pass to Jacob and Esau a blessing in relationship to the things that would come. Esau, when he found out that God had blessed Jacob, that Isaac had blessed Jacob, wept, and he asked him if there was still a blessing for him. Verse 39 of 27, Isaac his father answered and said unto him, Behold, thy dwelling shall be with the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. And by thy sword shalt thou live, and thou shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass when thou shalt have dominion, and thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. And in verse 28 now, because Esau wants to kill Jacob, Isaac, realizing that Jacob was God's choice, remembering how Abraham had sent Eleazar back to Paddan Aram to find him a bride so that he wouldn't marry a Canaanite. Chapter 28 says this, verse 1, And Isaac called Jacob, now the blessing, not the blessing in compromise and sin, but listen to this. Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said unto him, Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and take thee a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother. And God Almighty bless thee, and make thee fruitful, and multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people, and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee and to thy seed with thee, that thou mayest inherit the land wherein thou art a stranger, which God gave to Abraham. That is when the blessing comes upon Jacob. When Isaac does it with his full cognizance, with his mind, he realizes the mistake he had made, just as you and I make mistakes, just as you and I get embroiled in the examples that our parents have set, just as you and I get tangled up in family problems here and there. The idea is, as God looks at Isaac, God doesn't mention all of that. He mentions that Isaac, at the end of his life, was a good finisher, and that is the key. That's how we want to finish. We want to finish this race well, and at the end of his life, was able to pass a blessing in relationship to things to come by faith to his two sons, though he had never realized them. He had never seen them, and he was the son of promise and died blind, died with family struggles around him. Rebecca died. He died alone. He sends off his son Jacob, who he will not see for 30 more years. Rebecca will die in the meantime. Esau goes his way, and Isaac is left alone and blind to live to be 180 over 40 more years. But the interesting thing is this, if you'll turn to chapter 35. Verse 27 says this, "And Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, to the city of Arbah, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. And the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac gave up the ghost and died and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him." They were 120 by that time. The amazing thing is it says he ended his life at Mamre, which means to be strengthened, the verb Mamre. And he lived at Hebron, which is the verb to commune or to fellowship. And the reason that he was able to, by faith, pass the blessing to his sons at his death in regards to things to come was that they were real to him. He struggled along the way. We see his mistakes. We see him in solitude. We see him searching for the wells that he remembered his father had enjoyed and reopening those springs and finding refreshing. And at the end of his life, we find him blind. We find him never having seen the promises with the physical eye, but obviously in his heart, strengthened and in communion with the living God, which was the legacy he was able to pass. And for you and I, see, if we get into our desert experiences and we can't discover the well there of the one who lives and sees, what do we have to give to the next generation? What do we have to pass to them? What wells of their fathers will they open? If you and I haven't discovered at Beersheba, as it were, the well of the oath, that we can drink from a refreshing covenant that has been made in the blood of Christ, that has secured us and given us an inheritance undefiled that fadeth not away, that is kept for us in heaven. If you and I have not discovered that there is a plan for our life at Rehoboth, a well that tells us that there is a place for us, there is room for us. What will we have to give? You can't give somebody the measles unless you got it. You have to be infected if you're going to infect others. And for all of us, that will only come as we unstop those perpetual wells that have been there for every generation. They're the same. They never change. Of his presence and of his word and of his spirit. And every other thing that man tries to drink from leaves a nation and a church and an individual in the condition we witness around us so often. And the thing that we desire to pass, that I want to pass to my kids, that you want to pass, that you want to give to other, you know, you've discovered those places in your life where refreshing has flowed and there is a real relationship with the living God who hears and who sees and who has made covenant and who has made a place for you in his plan and in his divine designs. And we need to pray they will discover at the same springs and same wells those things, because success passes away and health passes away and relationships human pass away and money passes away and business savvy passes away. And we'll pass away from this world. And again, when I lay on my hospital bed, I don't care whether my kid is the president of the United States or whether he runs a gas station. I don't care if he's a councilman or a mayor or a carpenter. I need to know when they say goodbye to me, if the Lord tarries that long, that I'll see them in the morning. I need to know when I close my eyes that every one of them, whatever they do in life, have opened those wells and know the true and the living God and have received forgiveness through Christ, and that I can close my eyes and know that I'll see them again in eternity. There is nothing else that matters in this world. Do you have that this morning? Maybe you need to open the wells that your parents have enjoyed, and you found yourself empty and thirsty and unfulfilled with this world. Jesus said this, "Anyone who thirsts," and he closes the Bible this way, "let him come and drink of the water of life freely." The Greek word is undeservedly. And if you want to come this morning, you don't deserve it. You don't deserve that he died for you. I don't deserve that he would die for me. I don't deserve that he would make me his son. I don't deserve that he would withhold a place for me and reserve it for me in his kingdom. I don't deserve that he would let me stand in this pulpit, or that he let me have health, or let me have my next breath. I don't deserve any of it. But it says, whoever is thirsty and is willing to come and drink undeservedly, not deserving it, you can come and drink freely. You see, it's the religious person who wants to come, and they think by their own acts or by their own religious worship or by their own goodness or by going to visit the orphanage or go by doing this thing or the other thing that they have any right with God. And they're mistaken. The only approach to God for the sinner initially is to come undeservedly. And he says, if you come that way, you may drink freely. You do that this morning. You do it with the person who brought you. You can come up after the service and pray with us. We'll give you a Bible. We'll give you some literature to read. I encourage you, don't leave this morning without coming. That well, that spring is open and flowing today. It will be stopped at a point in time. Today it's open and it's flowing. And you can drink undeserving, freely, and be satisfied.